right. You can open your Bibles to the book of Numbers. We're doing a series from Genesis to Jesus. We're tracing the themes. So we just finished preaching all the way through Genesis. We've seen all these themes and all these promises. And now we're tracing those themes and those promises through to their fulfillment, to the answer, to the yes and amen of every promise in Jesus. And so that's what we've been tracing, and we'll cover that ground in just a minute. We'll start in Numbers a little bit, and then we'll dive into Joshua, and we'll dive into Judges. But I want to first develop a few of the themes that we're going to be noticing here in your heart. And the first thing is that you need God, that I need God. That is our deepest, most abiding, most absolute, most fundamental need, is that we desperately need God in order to be happy, in order to be safe, in order to be free, in order to have joy, in order to live at all. We need God. God is everything. Jesus is everything. He is the river. From his throne, it says, flows the river of delights. God is the source of all life and joy and peace and happiness. And whatever else you think that you need, whatever else you feel like you need, if I could just have this, then I would be okay. It's fundamentally a distraction if it's not understood in your mind and in your heart that it's actually God that you need most of all. Scott was talking about this in Sunday school this morning with regard to life and resurrection and where we look for life. And he pointed out an ad in a magazine about how if you come to Colorado, it will give you life. Come to Colorado and come alive, because it's beautiful and it's glorious and it's a great place, and here you will come alive. But you can't come alive here unless you have Christ. You can't come alive anywhere. Jesus is everything. So the story that we're covering from Genesis to Jesus is the story of restoring our broken relationship to God. Because he created us in fellowship with him. And through our sin, every one of us has been cut off from him, separated from him. And that's the source of all of our struggle, all of our problem. But God is reconciling us to himself. So that's the first thing. I want to scratch at that a little bit. That God is everything for you. He is everything for me. And the second thing is, so we want God. And if we don't want God more than anything, then our hearts are captive. That's idolatry. We're missing life. We're missing joy. We're missing everything. The second thing is that as human beings, we want God, but also we want paradise. As a race, as human beings, we are created in paradise. We were created to live in paradise, in this beautiful, abundant, fruitful garden where everything is good and everything is abundant. We're not made to live in a void. We're not made to live in darkness. We're made to live in God's place with God. God is our foundational delight. He's our joy. He's our everything. And then he carries that out by putting us in a garden, in a paradise, in Eden, in a place of beauty. And I think we get that somewhat here in Durango, because we live in this beautiful place, and we're drawn here. Many of us are drawn here to Durango because we're looking for that. We remember somewhere deep in our bones that we were a people created for beauty, a people created for paradise. We are made to delight in God directly and also in the things that he's made. And so the story of Genesis, the story from Genesis to Jesus, is the story of God bringing us back to paradise. The story of God reconciling us to himself and bringing us back to paradise. And the last thing is, we want God, we want paradise, and we want blessing. We need God's blessing. Life under God's blessing is the way it was meant to be. That's how humans were created. We were created to be in fellowship with God, to know him, but to be under his blessing. Like a flower can only blossom and open up in the sunlight, so we can only blossom and be who we were created to be under the blessing of God. The blessing of God is central to who we are and to what we're longing for. It's the blessing of God is life without death. The blessing of God is work without toil. The blessing of God is children without any hardship or struggle. It's God himself without guilt without shame. That's what God's blessing looks like. And the story of Genesis to Jesus is the story of God giving us himself back, reconciling us to himself, bringing us to a paradise where we will live with him there forever, and bringing us under his blessing where we will flourish in the kind of people we were made to be, those connected to God under his blessing. So let's look at the next chapter in this incredible story of God restoring us to himself, restoring us to paradise, and restoring us under his blessing. We're going to see this in Joshua and in Judges. We're going to see God restoring his people. So this is what's going to happen in what we're going to look at today. In this chapter of the story, God brings his people back to himself in a paradise under his blessing. That's what these books are about. And that's not just a story about Israel. This is your story. Your story is the story of God taking everybody who believes in him and restoring them to himself, restoring them to paradise, and restoring them to his blessing for all who will believe. So let's catch up in the story. Let's really quickly summarize, and then we'll jump in. The end of Numbers, maybe the middle of Numbers, and then Joshua and Judges. So God created the world. He created everything. He put man in Eden, in the paradise. God was there with him, and they were under his blessing. See, that's where it all started. God's people with God in his place under his blessing. And the fall, our rebellion and sin, did what? It broke the fellowship with God. It created a separation between us and him so that he does not hear. It resulted in exile and being sent out of the paradise, being sent out into the world and into the darkness of the world. And it resulted in God's curse, the opposite of his blessing. Our struggle, life turns to death. Work turns to toil. Children bring with them pain through childbearing. And that's where God placed the curse. So he created us there. We lost it. We rebelled against him. We lost it through sin. And then moving really quickly, God promises through a covenant to restore those things to a guy named Abraham. He says, I will be your God, your reward. I will be your exceedingly great reward, and I will bless you. And in you, I will bless a people from all the earth, and I will bring you into this great land, and I will give it to you and to your offspring. Okay? Do you see that? Again, God in his place with his people under his blessing. And that's what he promised to Abraham. And then we have Exodus to Deuteronomy. We have this promise made, and now we have his offspring growing up into that promise and receiving it. And you have Israel, his offspring, ending up in Egypt as slaves. At first they were delivered, but they were in exile, weren't they? Abraham was in Canaan. He was in this land that God was promising to give him, this paradise. But then they, through a famine, they had to leave, and they were in exile, again, in Egypt. And so God comes in, and he shows his power. He delivers them from their enemies in the Exodus, and we know about this, and he brings them through the Red Sea, and he rescues them, and he's bringing them where? Back to the promised land, back to the place of blessing, back to the place of paradise. That's where he's leading them. Deliverance from their enemies. He's bringing them to the land of Canaan, to the land of promise, to land flowing with milk and honey. He's bringing them to a paradise, and on the way there, he brings them to the mountain. And on the mountain, God comes down and he meets with them. And he gives them rules. And he enters into another covenant with them. And he says, will you obey my rules, and I will bless you. He says, here's all that I've done for you. I've rescued you. Now here's what I expect of you, summarized in the Ten Commandments. And if you will just keep these Ten Commandments, then you will go into this land. You'll have rest from your enemies. I will bless you, and everything's going to be great. So here's the path to the blessing that's been promised. Is you obey the law. You keep the law. And if you will obey the law, you will inherit the blessing. And that's what Sinai was all about. As Israel will obey God's law, they will have God in his place under his blessing. So do you see this bigger storyline developing here? This story of God restoring his people to himself, restoring a people to his blessing. So let's see how this gets spelled out over the course of the Bible. The first thing we're going to notice, you can be turning to Numbers in chapter 13. The first thing we're going to notice is that Israel, they've left Mount Sinai, they're headed off to the promised land, they've got the law, they've committed, we're going to keep it. All the things that the Lord has spoken to us, we will do them this day. We will keep it. We want God, we want the blessing, we want the paradise, we're going to obey. They head off, and they don't trust God, and they don't obey him, and so they can't enter paradise, and they end up with more curse. So the story takes a dark turn. As soon as they're leaving, they're headed off, and they distrust God. They disobey God and they lose paradise. So you know the story. Probably most of you are familiar with it. Some of you, if you aren't familiar with it, it's exciting to get to introduce you to the story for the first time. But God brings his people from the mountain. He's bringing them, and he brings them right to the edge of the promised land. And they come up to it, and they're encamped on the edge, and they send in. He says, just go in and get it. It's all yours. I'm good giving it to you. I'm with you. Don't worry about the enemies. You just go in and take it. And they decide, well, maybe it'd be good to have a plan. So let's send in a group of spies, and they'll check it out, and they'll come back and report to us. And then we can kind of have a plan of attack. They say, okay. The spies go in. They look all around. They come back, and they've got grapes. One cluster of grapes that says they have to carry on a pole on their shoulders. There's two guys with a pole between them and one cluster of grapes. That's how abundant the land is. It's a paradise. So they come back. We've scouted out the land. It's indeed fruitful. It's flowing with milk and honey. It is a paradise. But there are giants in there. The people are huge. We were like grasshoppers next to them. The sons of Anak, the giant ones, the mighty ones. It's a land inhabited by giants. So they come in. The spies bring back the report. The land is good, but the Nephilim are there, and we are afraid. And so their plan is to appoint a new leader who will bring them back to Egypt, where hopefully they can find some measure of success as slaves to Pharaoh. That's the plan. They accuse God of bringing them out there to kill them. So God's brought them, he's rescued them, he's shown them his power, he brings them out, he gets them to the border of the land, and they shrink back because of fear. They're afraid. We'd rather go back to being slaves. We'd rather go back to Egypt. We'd rather have somebody telling us what to do rather than move forward and receive the blessing and the freedom that God has promised for us. And this is crazy, because what have they just seen God do? They've just seen God topple Egypt, the world superpower. They've just seen God bend Pharaoh to his will. They've just seen God do mighty miracles, one after the other, after the other, after the other, and deliver them by a demonstration of his power, brings them to the Red Sea. He moved a sea out of their way and brought them through and crashed a sea down on their enemies. You would think that they would feel invincible. Our God can do anything. If these people come against us, he can pick up a sea and throw it down on them. That's what our God can do. We just watched him do it. But instead, they waver in unbelief. So Joshua and Caleb hear this, and they urge the people not to fear. They're urging them. So look at, here we can jump into Numbers 14. And first look at verses 8 to 10. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Then all the congregation said to stone them with stones. But the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the people of Israel. So the spies go into the land. Among those spies are two guys, Joshua and Caleb. And they're the only ones who say, we can do this. God's removed their protection. We've got them. We don't need to fear. We just walk forward in faith in God's promise, and we take the land. It's ours. But the people don't want to hear it. They try to stone them. And they're only saved when the glory of the Lord falls in the tent. This kind of cowardice that God's people express at the border of the promised land, this kind of lack of faith, this utter cowardice in the face of scary enemies, but knowing their God is with them, is a great sin. This is a huge sin. Look at verse 11, the next verse. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people despise me? And how long will they not believe in me, in spite of all the signs that I've done among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. We often talk about fear as though it's something that afflicts us, that we're victims of our fear. Well, I couldn't. I was too afraid. It was scary. People were big. I was afraid. I couldn't do it. I couldn't walk forward. What could I do? I was beset by fear. I was in the grip of fear, we say. My fear controlled me. And so we feel like we need sympathy when we're afraid. But God looks at his people. They have every reason not to be afraid. They have every reason to be afraid because their enemies are big, but they have every reason to believe that God will walk them through it. And when in that situation where God said, I promised I would be with you, I've demonstrated my power and my love towards you, and if with that promise you refuse to walk forward, that is despising God, he says. Did you see that in verse 11? The Lord said to Moses, how long will this people despise me? How long will they not believe in me in spite of all the signs that I have done among you? God sees giving way to our fear instead of trusting him as despising him. And God has similarly called us. He similarly called you specifically, and me specifically, every one of you, and us as a group, but each one of us individually, who have trusted in Jesus, who've been baptized, who are followers of Christ, he has entrusted to you, and he said, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. You go. Go into all the nations, go everywhere, go to every people, and you bring them to discipleship. You make disciples of them, and you teach them to observe everything that Jesus commanded. And we say, well, that's scary. It's scary to talk to somebody about Jesus. What if they laugh at me? What if they don't like me? What if they think I'm stupid? What if they get mad? What if I lose my job? Surely God wouldn't want me to have to do something like that. So we tremble and we falter and we comfort ourselves. We say, well, it's okay. I was afraid. I was nervous. So surely God should come surely God feels bad for me for being afraid. But it's not how he treats Israel on the border of the promised land when they refuse to go in. He says, I'm with you. Is God with you in mercy? Absolutely. Is he with you in grace? Absolutely. Is he with you in power? Absolutely. And now in that grace and in that power, he sends you to go. He says, be bold and courageous, and he promises to be with you. God has sent us into the nations in Christ to make disciples, and fear is not a reasonable or a right response. It's irrational. We've seen what God can do. We know who our God is. It doesn't make sense to be afraid of human beings when we have our God. We've been given a spirit, not of fear, but of power, and of love, and of self-control. So this is what God does. He brings his people to the edge of the land, and they're afraid. They're cowardly. They won't take the land. They're unbelieving. They don't trust God, and they want to go back to slavery. If this is what God brought us out here to do, we quit. We don't want to sign up anymore. We liked all that bit about getting free from slavery, but we don't like this bit about having to tear down giants. And so we're going back. We're going back to slavery. And as a result, Israel is not allowed to enter the land because of their unbelief. That's Numbers 14. They don't get to go. They don't get paradise. And in fact, God says, I'm just going to destroy them. I'm going to kill them all. Because I've shown them my power, I've shown them my love, I've shown them my grace, I've brought them out, I've sent them to the edge, and I'm utterly done with it. I'm going to strike them with pestilence, and I'm going to disinherit them. I'm done with them. And Moses, I'm going to raise up a new people from you to give my promises to. And Moses comes to the Lord and he negotiates. He comes to the Lord in prayer. Now, God knows everything that he's doing. He knows the beginning from the end. And yet, as a part of God carrying out his purposes, he brings people in through prayer to negotiate with him. And then he listens to those negotiations. None of this limits God's sovereignty and all those things we've talked about. But nevertheless, Moses comes and negotiates. God says, I'm done with them. I'm going to strike them with pestilence. I'm going to disinherit them. I'm going to bring up a new nation out of Moses. But Moses negotiates them not being cut off, but instead just kill this one generation, God. Instead of totally cutting the people off, just judge this generation who did this and forgive them and show them your mercy. And the way he does that is by appealing to the name that God had revealed to him back in Exodus chapter 34. He said, God, you said that you are abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, that you forgive iniquity and transgression and sin. You said that you are a merciful God. And so because that's how you have revealed yourself, you have promised yourself to be merciful, show your mercy to your people now. And God says, okay. So they wander in the desert for 40 years until the unbelieving generation has died off. Everybody above 20 years old, they go back out. So they've come through the wilderness. They've come to the edge of the land. They've refused to take it. So he says, back out to the land with you. 40 years, you're going to wander until you're all dead. And the next generation is going to get another chance. Except Joshua and Caleb, who had not given the unfaithful report, right? They had said, please don't do this. Please trust God. We can do it. So they wander in the desert for 40 years until all the unbelieving generation has died off. You see how important it is to trust God in the face of hard things. If we have God's promise, we have what we need. It's all that you need. No matter what he calls you to, his promise is enough. And how much does it glorify God when we walk into an impossible situation armed with nothing but his promise? When we walk into a situation and we say, you want me to fight that guy? I'm like a grasshopper compared to him. You want me to stand against nations? You want the small, embattled church? Not many of us were wise. Not many of us were noble. We're not a really great crew. We're not really powerful in and of ourselves. We're a weak lot. And he says, and you want us to stand against the nations and teach them to obey everything that Jesus did? You want us to go out and to walk in authority over demonic powers? To wrestle not just against flesh and blood, but to wrestle against demons? You want us to do that? We're like grasshoppers before them. We can't win these battles. These fights are too big for us. You want us to deal with that sin? You want us as a community to come around somebody whose life is falling apart, who seems just totally enslaved to sin? And you want us to get, what can we do? You want us to gather around them and minister life to them and restore them? But do you see how much it glorifies God when we just walk into whatever situation he puts in front of us with faith in his promise, that his gospel is enough, that he's going to change, that he's going to transform, that he's going to fix things, and that he's going to use his people to do it? It shows his power. So he brings them out into the land. They all die off. And now he brings them back, and he's going to give them another chance. After the judgment of the wilderness is completed, he brings Israel again to the land with Joshua as their new leader. So the second thing we see is that Joshua trusts God and leads Israel into the promised paradise. So we've got a major setback that we read about in Numbers. Now we're back in Joshua. We're back, headed back. Okay, regain our bearings. We're being restored to God. We're being brought to paradise. We're being given his blessing. We've just got to obey his law. He takes that seriously when his people don't believe. When they rebel against him, he strikes them down. He strikes them with pestilence. He considers disinheriting them and is talked out of it. Shows them mercy. But now they're back. They're going to go into the promised land, into the paradise with God under his blessing. And Joshua is going to lead them. So now we're in the book of Joshua. Joshua leads God's people into the land that God had promised to Abraham. Let's read together Joshua 1, 1 through 9. After the death of Moses, Moses has died, the servant of the Lord, the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I'm giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I've given to you, just as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit this land that I swore to their fathers to give to them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. The book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened, and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Amen. So you see the themes there. There are a bunch of themes that emerge there. One is God's promise. I promised it to Moses. I promised it to the fathers. I promised. Go get it. I swore to you, this is yours. No one will stand before you. The land is yours. Go take it. I promised you. Believe. So this is the promise. There's a theme of obeying all the commands to get God's blessing. Did you hear that? I mean, that was a central theme. I've given you the law. Obey it. That's your way to prosperity. That's how you're going to get it. That's how you're going to go in. You just keep all the covenant. And the other thing he said three times, be courageous. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Be very courageous. Be very strong. Do not be afraid. Remember what the generation before you did, right? They need to hear that one over and over. Trust God. Don't be afraid. And so they trust God, and God delivers the enemies into their hands. He gives them the land that they've promised, that He's promised to them. That's the book of Joshua. They go in, they're not afraid, they conquer, and they tear down. Now, there are setbacks, where they're, you know, He says, don't take any of these people's treasure. They take some of the treasure, hides it under His tent, and then they lose. Now they start losing. They're like, what happened? Somebody's disobeying the law. Somebody's not keeping the commands. They find the guy, Achan, they punish him, they go back, and the victory is resumed. They're taking the land. God is giving them the land He promised. He delivers their enemies into their hands. He gives them the promised land. So what does this show us? What did the book of... read the book of Joshua. I mean, it's good. That's the story of it. It's like the conquest of the land. Then these people came against them, and they won. And these people came against them, and they defeated them. The angel of the Lord's leading them. I mean, there's all this great stuff. And what we see is that Israel needed a courageous leader who would trust God and lead them into God's paradise and blessing. That's what they needed. On their own, they're trembling, they're afraid, they're trying to go back. But they needed this courageous leader who would trust God in their place. And God provided this leader in Joshua. Joshua was the guy. He was the guy who went out in front and he trusted God and he said, follow me, and we're going. And they followed him and they went. And God was with them. They needed a leader who would lead them, who would trust God on their behalf and lead them in triumph. And what's his name? Joshua. How do you say Joshua in Hebrew? Anybody know? Yeshua. How do you say Yeshua in Greek? Yeshus. Yeshus. And how do you say Yeshus from Greek in English? Jesus. So the name Joshua is this, it's Jesus. It's the same name. If you were to say the name Jesus in Hebrew, it's Yeshua. It's Joshua. They don't have J's, right? They have Y's. It's Joshua. So God sends them a Jesus. And this Jesus acts in faith, he walks in faith, and he leads the way. He trusts God, and he leads the way, and he's given the land. That's what they're given, and that's what they need. And that's what we need, too. Listen to Joshua 21. Here's the summary. Joshua 21, 43 to 45. Now here, we're going to summarize the whole book. So we're going quick. Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers. They got it all. And they took possession of it, and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. So this theme of the promise, he swore to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass. All of it. They got all the land. All the land God promised them, they inhabited. They took it. God gave it to them. They took it over. It's all theirs. All the land. It's done. The promise is completed. For some reason, there's been a theme in the teaching of the church that says they never inherited all the land, so they're going to have to go back and redo it. But I don't know where that teaching comes from, because this verse is really, really clear. Every little bit of promise of the land, he gave it to them. He said, it's all yours. It's all here. They inherit the land that God promised. Joshua leads them in. They're in the paradise. Rest from their enemies. They've got it. They've got the land. They've got they're in the paradise. God is with them. Remember, they have the tabernacle and he's with them. He's living among them in this tent. We talked about that last time. God's with them. They're in the land. And all these promises are coming to pass. They're blessed by God. So is this it? Like, is this the fulfillment? Is this the restoration that God has been promising? This has got to be on Israel's mind. It's all happening. We're here. We're in the paradise. We're back in God's place. This is Eden restored. I think we're on the cusp of everything coming to be. God's people in God's land. God's dwelling with them in His tabernacle. But we know the story. We know that the story, this isn't the end of the story. And we know that, no, this isn't the restoration of Eden. It's not even close. It remains a shadow of Eden at best, a shadow of God's promise. Because there's not full reconciliation with God. The whole law, this whole covenant enshrines that the people are separated from God. The only way they can approach God in the tabernacle is through the one priest, and they all have to stay back. Remember the picture I gave you last time is that they're kind of in God's backyard a little bit, but they can't come into the house where God is. That's the Holy of Holies. And one guy every once in a while can kind of open the door and peek his head in, and then he's got to close it really quick and come back, or else he's going to die. God's going to break out against him. We're missing something. This isn't what we had in Eden. This is worse than what we had in Eden. God's with them, so it's better than what they had for a while, but it's not everything. God still lives behind the curtain. And he's not yet blessed the nations, has he? I mean, he's driven a bunch of them out, and he's blessing Israel, he's blessing Abraham's offspring. But the promise to Abraham was, I'm going to bless a family from all the families of the earth. I'm going to make a people, and I'm going to give them blessing. We're not seeing that yet. There's still more that needs to happen. So Joshua renews the covenant. They get there. There's a shadow of the fullness, and they've got to be thinking, maybe this is it. So Joshua renews the covenant, and the people swear, we're going to follow God, and we're never going to turn away from him again. We're really going to do it this time. This is in Joshua 24. God reminds them, here's all the things I've done for you. He traces the story all the way from Abraham, just like we've been doing. He traces the promises all the way. And then God calls them to worship him alone. He says, I've rescued you, I've saved you, I've done this, I've brought you. And all this story that we've just been recounting, God reminds them of all of it. And then God says, now you worship me alone in light of all this. That's Joshua 24:14. Look at that with me. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. This is the center of it, right? This worship God. Remember, he's the source. He's everything we need. So he's saying, just worship me alone. And this is where your blessing comes from. Stop turning to these other false gods. And they agree. Yep, okay. That's what we're going to do. We're in the land. We're on the cusp of everything coming back. God says, worship only me. Okay, we're going to worship only you. That's Joshua 24:15. If it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, you guys know this verse, choose this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Then the people answered, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For it is the Lord our God who brought us and our fathers up from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who did these great signs in our sight, and preserved us in all the way that we went, and among all the peoples through whom we passed. And the Lord drove out from before us all the peoples, the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore we also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. The people are recommitting. God's allowing them to renew. It's like they're renewing their vows, okay? We've screwed up. We've gone astray. We've been unfaithful from day one. They were unfaithful. Remember, before he even got down from the mountain, they were worshiping an idol. God considers this spiritual adultery. Remember, the covenant is like marriage. They're already worshiping the calf before he even gets down. But God forgives them. They come in. Then they refuse to trust him. He shows them mercy. He forgives them. He gives them everything. He says, okay, let's renew the vows. Let's renew the vows. Let's start from scratch. Remember everything I've done for you. I'm for you. I'm with you. I'm going to bless you. Just stop going to other gods. Stop committing spiritual adultery. And they say, okay, we're in. So renew the covenant. And Joshua gives a response that's maybe strange to our ears. You'd think Joshua would say, oh, that's good. Like, I see a little bit of faith. I'm going to just encourage that. And yes, you can do it. Just reach down deep and you'll find the faith you need to be faithful. But that's not what he says at all. In verse 19, but Joshua said to the people, you are not able to serve the Lord, for he's a holy God. He's a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good. What in the world? I mean, why is that Joshua's response? It's the renewal of the vows, and God says, here's what I've done. I'm showing you mercy. I'm going to restore you to myself, give you the paradise, and give you blessing. And they say, okay, we'll do it. And he says, no, you won't. You're not able to do it. You're too broken. And if you don't do it, and if you continue to serve foreign gods, God is going to consume you. He's a holy God. Israel still needs something more because they still have unfaithful hearts. I was going to say unfaithfulness in their hearts, but they have unfaithful hearts. They're unable to be true to God. They're unable to respond to his covenant promises. They're unable to be faithful in this relationship with their God. They've been here before. God says, I've heard this before. We've been down this path. Whatever you say, we're going to do it. We're in. But immediately they turn, pledging their obedience and covenant to God. Joshua has seen how quickly they fall and they break the covenant and forfeit the blessing. So again, this points us forward to the need for something more, a greater act of redemption, even than the Exodus. God's got to do something bigger, because you can take your people out of exile, but you've got to get exile out of your people. Because their hearts are still exiled hearts. Their hearts are still far from God. So it points us forward to a greater redemption, a greater rest. Joshua brought them into a rest, but that rest was not sufficient. Because if the rest that Joshua had brought them into, remember this is our New Testament reading from Hebrews, if the rest that Joshua had brought them into had been sufficient, then there would have been no talk of a greater rest yet to come in David. But there was, because this rest that they have is not sufficient. This promised land, this paradise, and this connection with God is not enough. We need more. Joshua brought Israel into rest, but there remains a greater rest that will await a greater Joshua. One who can not only believe and lead, but one who can give God's people a new heart of faith. So that's what we need. We need new hearts. These hearts that we have are not able to stay in covenant with God. They just stray over and over. Does anybody know that? Do you know? Like, if you're going to come to Jesus, you need to have come to grips with that about your own heart. If you've never, like, putting your trust in Jesus involves saying, I have an adulterous heart, and I cannot worship God, and I can't keep His promises, and I can't maintain faithfulness to His covenant. And I won't, and I don't even want to. And then we cry out to God, and we say, God, I need a new heart, because this one doesn't love You. This one isn't faithful to You. I need salvation. I need more than just political rescue. I need more than the right laws. Even the laws written by God's own hand. I need more than a paradise. I need You. I need a new heart. I need new creation. I need resurrection from the dead. Joshua brought Israel out of exile. The greater Joshua will have to bring the exile out of Israel. Joshua led God's people in faithfulness. But when he died, things fell apart. As soon as Joshua's off the scene, they're tanking again. So they need a Joshua who will never die. And so that pattern continues. And here's the last thing. I'm going to summarize Judges quickly. Joshua's discouraging prediction is borne out. They say, we'll keep everything the Lord says. Joshua says, no, you won't. And then Joshua dies. And his pessimistic prediction is borne out. And this is the book of Judges. Israel breaks the covenant, and God rescues them. That's the story of the book of Judges. Right? God rescues them. They disobey. They rebel against Him. They worship other gods. He has mercy on them. He rescues them. He restores them. Then that judge dies. And then they do it again. They immediately start rebelling again. And so God looks on them with mercy. And He sends them a deliverer. And He rescues them. And He raises them up. And then He dies. And they fall back into it. Listen to Judges 2, 11 to 19. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroths. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against them. And He gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And He sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and He saved them from the hand of their enemies all the day of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted them and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. That's the story. That's Judges in a nutshell. That's Judges in two sentences. That's the book. It's just over and over and over. God will send a Gideon, and he'll rescue them by his power and show his mercy, and then they sin. And God will send a Samson, and Samson, for all of his craziness, will rescue them and bring down a bunch of enemies even in his death, and then he dies, and the people just get worse. And it's not only they keep doing it, did you hear that? But they get worse even than their fathers. They continue to rebel. We need a deliverer who will live forever. We need a rescuer who won't die. We need a rescuer who will last forever. And so then here's the end of the book of Judges, and we'll wrap up. The book of Judges ends on this two depressing notes. The last story in the book of Judges, so everything's looking up, it's the fulfillment of all the promise, it's all happening, we're going back into paradise. But the last story in Judges is about this Levite who comes to the tribe of Benjamin, and he's got this concubine, he's got this girl with him, and they're staying in somebody's house, and then a whole horde of people, a whole crowd of people come against the house, and they're pounding on the door, and they're trying to break in, and they're trying to steal them and violate them. Okay? For a long time, I didn't even know that there were two stories in the Bible about this because they're so much the same. We just went over this in Genesis when the angels came to stay with Lot in Sodom. And the crowd came and they pounded and they beat down the door and they tried to take them. It's the same thing is happening again. But now it's happening in Benjamin. Now it's happening to God's people. What's the point? Israel has become as bad as Sodom. And I'll let you read the details. It's worse than I'm explaining right now. I mean, it's really, really bad. That's the last story in Judges. So this is where it's headed. It's just getting worse and worse and wickeder until the last verse of Judges tells us about the desperate situation. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. There's no ruler. There's no judge. Everybody's just running around doing whatever they want. And it's just pure wickedness. What had happened to the promise that they would do whatever God commanded? That they would do what was right in God's eyes, that they wouldn't turn to other gods, that they would stay faithful. The story is starting to get a little hopeless with Israel, isn't it? Before he could even come down the mountain, they're sinning. Everywhere they go, they come to the land and they're sinning. They can't even take it. He brings them back into the land. He's rescuing them, but they can't take it. They won't be faithful. They won't uphold their end of the covenant. There's a hint there at the end that maybe a king can help them. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everybody did what was right in his own eyes. So we start thinking, maybe if they had a good king, then maybe a king could help them out of this mess. And so that's where the story will take us next. God gives them a king. He gives them a kingdom. And that points again towards the fullness. It points again towards God's redemption. But we'll see that even that won't be enough. We'll need a rescuer who will live forever. So let me tie this up. Let me pull these themes together. I know this is a downer, but these are the books. This is where the story goes. We have to see. We have to face our heart, don't we? We have to face the human condition. While Israel has God's presence in the tabernacle, they have been brought into the paradise of Canaan, and they have the promise of God's blessing, they continue to do what Adam did. They're starting to see all the promise come to fruition, completely in spite of themselves, but they continue to lack hearts of faith. They continue to mistrust God, thinking there's something better somewhere else. There's something better back there in Egypt as slaves. There's something better among the gods of the nations. There's something better somewhere. There's something that will satisfy me. There's something that will make me happy. There's something that will save us, will rescue us, will be all that we've been longing for. Anything but Yahweh, anything but Him will satisfy. They continue to look to other gods to give them what only God can give them. As He continues to show them mercy and say, I alone can provide life. They continue looking to other peoples and thinking somehow they have it better outside covenant with Yahweh. They continue failing to keep God's law in order to inherit the blessings. Something more is needed. God's people's hearts and minds are poisoned. That's what's starting to emerge. Their hearts are broken. They're dead. God's people are dead to God. They're dead to joy. They're dead to worship. They're dead to righteousness. We don't have it in us. They need a greater Joshua to lead them into the perfect rest. They need life from the dead and a new heart. They need somebody to keep the covenant for them to bring them into the blessing. How are they ever going to get the blessing? Because another theme that I keep bringing up, and just stay tuned, but I don't want to leave this one hanging completely. They need somebody to keep the law. I mean, if you notice this, he keeps telling them, all you got to do is just keep all the commandments and then you'll get the blessing. You get the land, you'll get me. What's starting to emerge? It's not happening. We can't keep the law. We can't do it. The law is just revealing how far short we're falling of it. We can't do it. They need somebody to keep covenant for them. Someone to bring them into the blessing. They need someone to lead them in faith. They need a better Joshua. They need a leader who will never die. They need a king who will never die. They need Jesus. The picture is starting to clarify through the history of the Bible as the stories are unfolding. What do we need? We need Jesus, and so do we. And we have him. We have Jesus. So we don't have to go through this series pretending like Jesus hasn't come. We've got to follow the story. We've got to embed ourselves in the story so we can understand how this thing is unfolding. But I want to remind you at the end that we have Jesus. That you, right now, so back to those first things that we started off with. We have God, we have his paradise, and we have his blessing. You have all of those things currently. We have all of those things presently, and we grab a hold of them by faith, and we need to not shrink back and let go of that. You have access to God and Jesus. There's a new and living way behind the curtain. We don't have to stay outside. We're in God's presence. We have restoration with God, just to enjoy it. And as we drink deeply from the well that is God, we don't need to run everywhere else that never satisfied. We can be totally satisfied in him. We can go behind the curtain. We can know God. We have access. And when he comes back again, we will see him as he is, and we will be perfectly made like him. We're being given the whole world as a new Eden in paradise in Jesus. You are, right now. That was our call to worship. He says, why are you saying, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas? Don't you know that Paul is yours, that Cephas is yours, that Apollos is yours? In fact, don't you know the whole world is yours? He tells them, everything is yours. And he says, and you're Christ's, and Christ is God's. Everything is yours because everything is Christ's. The whole world is being turned into the Eden paradise. That's what Adam and Eve were supposed to do, is take Eden and push it out into all the rest of the creation. It's what Adam failed to do, and it's what Jesus is doing right now. And he's giving it all to his people. He's restoring the world to a new Eden in Jesus. And when he comes, he will renew the whole thing, and he will make it perfect. But it's yours. And lastly, we have the blessing of God in Jesus. We have the blessing. We have God's favors. Like I said, what is God's blessing? It's like a flower can't flourish and be what it was created to be without the sunlight shining on it. So you can be who you were created to be under the blessing of God because you have God's blessing in Christ. And when Christ returns, it will be fullness of joy in this blessing. So as we continue in this story, we're going to see just how it is that Jesus brings us all these amazing things. We're going to keep following that line, and we're going to see that everything that we need, that everything that we are, has been provided for us. But first, we've got to see how desperately we need it and how absolutely, utterly impossible it is for us to have anything apart from Christ.